Good afternoon, members. Welcome to today's meeting of the Ways and Means Committee on April 29th. We do have minutes before us. I'm at a loss. My minute reviewer is not with us. Vice Chair Scott, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, and I move them.
Vice Chair Scott recommends approval of the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. The minutes are approved. We seem to be missing some key players this morning. I will, while we're waiting, I'll do a little song and dance for you. Very little. Today we are going to be hearing a couple of bills right off the bat as soon as the authors arrive. Then we are going to recess, members. The last three bills on the agenda are still works in progress, so we will not be hearing those immediately during this 1 o'clock time period. We will instead potentially reconvene later today, and we will give you as much notice as we possibly can on that. Should we get any of these bills ready for action, we will pass them out today. Just remind members that if we don't come back in order, the committee expires at midnight, so there's no, we don't have to come back anytime soon, certain, and if we decide not to come back, we will let you know. So, members of the gallery, if you are here for the first two bills on the agenda, Bierman 4466 or Noor 729, you'll want to stay. If you're here for the last three bills on the agenda, Schumacher 4338, Norris 8856, or Norris 2354, you're not going to hear them. You're not going to hear about them. So. Just to let you know in case you want to have free time. With that, members, I will call Representative Bierman to the testifier stand. I will move House File 4466 come before the committee, and I believe, Representative Bierman, your motion is that this bill be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that is my motion.
Thank you. Representative Bierman moves that House File 4466 be approved and referred to the General Register. We have an A8 amendment. Representative Bierman, would you care to explain the amendment?
The A8, Mr. Chair, is a couple of technical fixes that research discovered, and so we're just doing that now to take care of those. If we want a fuller explanation, I believe Annie Mock is here.
I want you to
do that.
Louder.
Is she not?
Okay, A8 is before us. Any questions for members regarding the A8 amendment to House File 4466? Seeing none, I move the A8. Amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed by the same sign. Mr. Representative Bierman, your bill is amended to the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry. Hold on a second, Representative Bierman. I may have jumped ahead too quickly. We have a couple more amendments to consider. The A9 amendment, Representative Katiza Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to present the A9 amendment. Members, this is a very lengthy amendment. It is 141 pages. The first 120 pages are Article 4 and 5, which are about child care licensing modernization. This is a project that the department, both at DHS and DCYF, have been working on with child care providers and advocates and legislators for a number of years. Actually, we initialized a project back in 2019 when Chair Pinto was chairing the Early Childhood Education Committee Subcommittee, and so this began this multi-year process to discuss with childcare providers, parents, advocates, as I mentioned, on how to tighten up our licensing process. And so this includes years of work. The lead on the DFL side was Representative Nathan Coulter. The lead on the GOP side was Representative Danny Nadeau. Chair West has also been intimately involved in this process, and I believe at one point said that it was his top priority for the year. There are a number of other bills that are included. So if you skip to page 120, at the bottom of page 120, you will see an article for crisis nursery licensing. The Chair Torkelson himself has carried this bill on behalf of a wonderful organization that is in his district. There's also a crisis nursery in Minneapolis and one in St. Paul. We are hopeful that with the direction to the department in this proposal, they will be able to create a single crisis nursery licensing package. Currently, crisis nurseries are required to be licensed as two separate facilities because they provide overnight care and they provide ongoing care in addition to emergency care. So there's a couple complications there. It's a very good bill, and look forward to having that as a part of our child care infrastructure. Article 7, members, on page 121 is a Nadeau, Representative Nadeau bill, which has to do with MFIT and SNAP benefits and drug testing. Article 8 on page 122 is a Representative Bjorn Olson bill, which allows child care providers to self-report if they have violated a conditional license or correction order, and then that's publicly posted, something that child care providers have been asking for. And I appreciate Representative Olson's work on that. Let's see, then here, page 125, this is a Representative Ben Bakeberg bill on recognizing physical abuse. There is a poster that is required to be publicly available in child care centers so that parents can recognize the symptoms and signs of abuse to help keep our children safer. Article 9 is a section on child protection and welfare, which includes bills from Representative Clardy, Representative Hicks, Representative Pinto, and Representative Liebling. They impact children in school-age care programs in foster care so that they're able to more easily be admitted to programs that they have access to, but that we're changing the priority for children in foster care simply because parents who foster parents don't always have a lot of extra money to help support and find other after-school care programs, as well as those extended family and kinship care providers who are welcoming extended family into their home, but certainly are doing so at a fiscal and financial cost to their household. And then finally, members, on page 139 is where the appropriation section begins. So there is an appropriation for Chair Torkelson's bill to create a crisis nursery license that the department has requested, as well as funding for the parent support outreach program, which is carried by Vice Chair Hansen. This program is one of the most well-researched and well-utilized programs to support parents in need, and truly every dollar that can be invested into this program makes a huge difference in the care and keeping of our Minnesotans. And then finally, the last provision is House File 2136, which is a Representative Pete Johnson provision, which is allocating grant funding for forensic interview training scholarships. And this is something that is just so critical when we think about children who have been abused sexually or otherwise, children who have been through trauma, children who have witnessed domestic violence potentially, and this allows interviewers to be trained in this specialized interview process to make sure that they're not re-traumatizing children and to ensure that these children don't have to tell their story over and over and over again while they are helping us do our work to ensure that we keep other children safe and get to the bottom of the process that these children have been a party to due to no fault of their own. So, Mr. Chair, in short, this A9 amendment is the non-controversial bipartisan work of the Children and Families Committee this year. And I think that, you know, there is it's a relatively small cost. Certainly we were not given any committee budgetary targets. And I think we've done a very good job to pare down our priorities in terms of fiscal asks. And, I think that this is truly our last chance to create a House position on the care and keeping of Minnesota's youngest residents. And I would ask for a green vote.
Thank you, Representative Katisa Watun. Would either of the authors of the underlying bill care to comment on the A9 amendment? Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair, I look at the A9 as a friendly amendment, and I would ask for members' approval.
Chair Backer.
Yes. A lot of good information here, but this was an interesting bill to put together, and with us to continue to work with the other body, I would ask members to vote no.
Thank you. Any other member comments or questions regarding the A9 amendment? Representative Katisa Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did just want to point out that I have shared information through this process with the chair, with my co-chair, with co-chairs Backer and Bierman as well, to make sure that everybody was in the loop on how this has moved through the process. And it is news to me that the recommendation from the Republican side is a no vote to this amendment. So I'm disappointed to hear that. I think, you know, that we've done really great work in children and families this year because of the committee structure on in the other body. There is not a children and families committee over there. Our work gets bundled with the work of the human services and the health committee on an annual basis. And I don't see how this amendment doesn't have its place within the package that we are going to hopefully vote out and support and send to the other body eventually for a conference. So again, I would ask members to consider supporting, and I would request a roll call.
A roll call requested, roll call granted. Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many of these provisions within this amendment currently sit in this committee, and I would very much like to see them advanced. So if we do in a future hearing, we should move those bills forward, as well as some of the provisions are also on the floor. And the Senate is carrying many of these, and it can be a discussion in conference committee, but I will not be supporting the amendment.
Thank you, Representative West. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Collins-Watun, for bringing this. And I appreciate the bipartisan manner in which you did it. Looking at the package, I think it seems to be pretty fairly done in terms of spreading the love around for members and the bills that they have in here. I do think it's important, as always, when we go into these conversations with our Senate colleagues, that we have a very strong position. And anytime we are discussing areas involving our young people and the ways that we need to protect them and provide resources, I think we should, as Republicans and as Democrats, we should be in one and have a unified, clarifying message. And I believe this amendment actually does that. So thank you for bringing it. Members, I would request a yes vote.
Well, thank you, Chair Frazier, and thank you for bringing the amendment forward, Representative Katisa Watun, Chair Katisa Watun, but I am also going to recommend a no vote at this time, although I certainly have some friendly thoughts about portions of this amendment. It greatly expands the bill before us. Roll call being requested. We'll take the vote.
Chair Torkelson.
No.
Chair Frazier.
Yes.
Vice Chair Scott.
No.
Vice Chair Agbaje. Representative Akam.
Aye.
Representative Backer.
No.
Representative Baker.
No.
Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Representative Gomez. Representative Heintzman.
No.
Representative Igo.
Igo, no.
Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne, aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Katiza Watun.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
No.
Representative Kreshaw.
Kreshaw, no.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Noor.
Noor, aye.
Representative Novotny.
No.
Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Representative Swedzinski.
Swedzinski, no. Swedzinski, no.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative West.
No.
Representative Joachim.
Yes.
Representative Vice Chair Agbaje. Representative Gomez.
With 12 ayes and 14 noes, the bill, the amendment is not adopted. Amendment is not adopted. We'll move on to the A11 amendment of Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would move the A11.
Thank you. The A11 amendment is before us. Representative Scott, your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a new section of that's being proposed on in Article 2, starting on page 15, that has to do with the all-payer claims database. And I want to draw members' attention particularly to page 17, where it's talking about the fees. And the process around here, when we're talking about data and data sets, is that something like this should come to the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee, because that's where we deal with these issues. This new section never came to our committee. And so I hope that the chair will indulge me while I ask a few questions, since this wasn't brought before our committee, and I do have several questions that I would like to have answered. And I don't know if the bill's authors can answer these, or if there's someone here from the Department of Health that can help answer these questions.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, I have the
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bierman.
The department is here, and I think I'll just ask them to come up. And while they are coming up, we can start.
All right, sounds good.
I just did want to mention the APCD is an essential piece of new policy for us in the health field, and really have helped a lot with opioid addiction, rare disease, and healthcare spending drivers. And the next step is prior authorization, so we can have better insight. But we have. Director Gildemeister is here to answer detailed questions.
To your question, Representative Scott.
Thank you. It's questions, Mr. Chair. Questions, plural. Okay, so if de-identified data or limited use data sets are re-identified by someone who purchases this data, how would we know?
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your answer.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Minnesota Department of Health, and it's our team that maintains the APCD, provides oversight, and analyzes the data as well. To your question, Vice Chair Scott, the data is de-identified. It comes in a de-identified form to MDH, so it lacks information such as name, address, birth date. There are no images on there for individuals whose data are there. We don't know who's in the data. As the data, the process for data sharing involves a couple of steps that ensures that re-identification does not happen. So number one, I think re-identification is really difficult because the data is de-identified. Number two, we're working with we will establish an advisory group that will carefully vet applications to use the data for public uses. Number three, the data sets will be designed with minimally necessary data elements to limit exactly what you're describing. And then number four, researchers will use the data systems over which the state has oversight, and we monitor use of the data. Finally, none of the data can be taken off the system without MDH review.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I heard an answer in there that if someone is de-identifying the data, then what happens? And is there any penalty in law or in these contracts that you sign with these folks? Is there any penalty for de-identifying that data and then maybe selling it on again? I mean, we're selling it here. We're selling personal claims data, health data to people. Even though you say it's de-identified, it does include their birth date, their zip code, and their town. That's federal law, 45 CFR 164.51. So help me understand how that would work if it's re-identified and sold. Would there be a way for the Department of Health to know?
With the question,
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Scott, I neglected to clarify that yes, we would have a contractually enforceable data use agreement. And that binds people to complying with the Minnesota Data Practices Act. And there is enforcement built into it in violating contracts and making available data. It is our intent to ensure, to monitor the use of the data through tools where we track how people use the data, but also to prevent additional data coming onto the system. So, but yes, in direct answer to your question, and I'm sorry that I didn't catch that at first, there is an enforcement authority tied to Chapter 13.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is there any restriction on who this data can be sold to? Could it be sold to someone outside of the United States?
To the question.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Scott, the provision, maybe a small correction. We don't think of these data as being sold. We think of these data as being made available for specific targeted, time-limited research projects, at the end of which these data must be destroyed. And it's our job to ensure that that happens. Remember also that these data are not coming off the system. So selling them to somebody else, giving them away, putting them on your home computer. There are administrative software, physical tools to prevent that. As to permitting entities, researchers outside of Minnesota to use the data, I think it would be hard to imagine that their proposal would fit the requirement that these data are used in the public interest for Minnesotans. But again, to reiterate, the language that passed in 2023 requires the Health Department to ensure these data are only used for a public interest of Minnesotans.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. So I didn't hear a definitive no that they couldn't be. It's just that you couldn't imagine they would be, but as we know in this world, he who owns the data is king, right? So that gives me some concern. is would an entity that's required to submit data to this database be required to purchase a copy of the data under this new law? So if we have an Allina clinic that's supplying all this data, would they then have to pay to get access to their own data?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Scott, it really depends on the on the aim of the proposal. So it's entirely feasible, for example, that self-insured employers who contribute data to the APCD and wish to benchmark the prices that they face or to support the fiduciary duty that they have vis-a-vis their employees, that they get a fee waiver. So the language, again, from 2023 has built in a fee waiver, which the commissioner may grant.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill's definition of a limited use data set acknowledges that it may include protected health information from which certain direct identifiers of individuals have been removed. This means some protected health information, or PHI, and identifiers will remain in the data being sold. Is there a list of all the types of PHI and identifiers that may be included in these limited data sets?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Scott, if it's okay with the committee, I would like to provide this after I phone a friend. And I wanted to correct Vice Chair Scott, the data does not contain people's birth date. So what information is contained in the data is a person's sex, the 5-digit zip code at which they reside, and then included in these data are information on the procedures that were provided, the price for those, the diagnosis under which these services were delivered.
Mr. Gildemeister, you can start dialing if you would like. To phone your friend, that is.
My text.
Chair Scott.
So I'm confused because you said that there's no PHI, but on 17.21, it says limited use data set means a data set that meets the requirements of Code of Federal Regulations, Title 45, which I just alluded to, and may include protected health information from which certain direct identifiers of individuals have been removed under the principle of minimum necessary information. That reads as if there's some personal identifying information that still may be part of those data sets. So so while you phone the friend, I'll go on with kind of my last question here, Mr. Chair. Why the price difference between these different kinds of data sets?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Scott, the price difference really has to do with the effort the health department must put into designing and maintaining these data sets. So the lowest price data is a fixed format data set that would require relatively little effort to maintain. The customized data set that would be targeted to certain clinical or policy questions just require more effort up front to design these data sets so that they are targeted to the questions that the researcher requests to use these data for. And of course, the process involves making sure that the data elements available to individuals are the minimally necessary data elements.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, minimally necessary may vary depending on what the researcher is applying for, right? So I'll just restate that I have concerns that this never came to the Judiciary Committee for full vetting. I have even greater concerns about the underlying language that greatly expanded this program in 2023. I know that this is a delicate bill right now, so I'm going to withdraw my amendment. But I would just ask for in the future that anything to do with this all payer claims database and the use of people's health data come to the Judiciary Committee for a full vetting. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll withdraw the A11, I think it is.
That's correct. Chair Scott withdraws the A11 amendment. We have completed the list of amendments to the bill. Chair Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will begin, and I believe my co-chair would like to say a few words when I'm completed. Maybe he can end on a higher note than I will. House File 4466 is the Health, Finance, and Policy Bill. And I will tell you, I am neither pleased nor enthused to be one of its chief authors in its current state. The bill is less than modest in its proposals and does not address key health care needs in this state that our people need and deserve. The bill is primarily, simply, an alignment with the Trump and Republican Medicaid cuts, changes, and restrictions of H.R. 1, which will set health care in this state and our country back for a decade if allowed to stand for that long. To be clear, H.R. 1 is injurious, wasteful, and misguided policy. While it is bad, even disastrous, it is also here. And we as a state must align or face even more harmful consequences from this federal government. Today, I will not be telling people how to vote. I will be a mess. I will be a yes because this bill must get better for me to vote for it after conference committee. To the bill as H.R. 1 provisions, this bill includes a 45-day look-back period for work requirements, a one-month retroactive eligibility look-back for the expansion population, 2 months for everyone else. It conforms to both 2028 provisions on cost-sharing and home equity. And then beyond the H.R. 1 alignment, we have a very few member bills. There's a Rep. Ryer physical therapist scope bill that changes on-site supervision. There's the forecast bill, of course. There is three Representative Hewitt bills on reciprocal license internships as they learn supervisor oversight and alternates to be permitted for mortuary science. And also some changes to the natural organic reduction bill. Co-Chair Backer has an insulin bill, and Representative Schultz has a bill for private pool owners to be able to utilize their home pools for swimming education. That's all that's in the bill. It is the shortest health bill I've seen in 8 years up here. And really look forward to doing more work with the co-chair and with all of you moving this bill forward. It really does need to be worked on, and I want to again emphasize the impacts of H.R. 1, which are things that we need to do, unfortunately, through alignment or risk some pretty harsh retribution. So the bill, including H.R. 1, will increase costs for the state, for all the counties, drive increased uncompensated care at our hospitals, and cause higher health care premiums for each and every one of us. H.R. 1 will lower taxes for the ultra-rich and help increase the national debt to over $38 trillion if you're into that sort of thing. So I believe that specifically this bill can be improved if we put in some policies to address the pressing needs of mental health treatment, substance use disorder, and direct some focus, more focus on the critical shortage of direct care professionals and specialized in-home support professionals, which are especially needed in greater Minnesota. These additions, at a minimum, would make this bill more worthy of passage and something I could support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Backer to the bill.
Yeah, thank you. And it's a It has been a pleasure, continues to be a pleasure to work with Co-Chair Bierman. You know, us Minnesotans, we are independent. So whenever the federal government puts something on us, which I would refer to as the parent, and they make up 90% of a lot of our payout, we are required to fall in line, or members, we would lose $3.5 to $4 billion a year. So I don't think none of us likes that. I'm not saying that I'm head over heels with HR 1 conformity. At the same time, I am very concerned if we do not work within the parameters set by the federal government, like we've seen years past with the Affordable Care Act and other bills that have came down. We were encouraged, pushed, whatever word you want to say, to conform with that. So this is a lean bill. It is focusing on what matters, and that's health care and conforming with the federal government. And we've had a lot of discussions. We'll continue to have discussions because I think it's very important for the House. And I appreciate also Co-Chair Bierman appreciates we get into the conference committee and the House has a position. Because, folks, if we do not conform, we're talking about a huge amount of money that's lost. And there's not many dials that we could have dialed. And a lot of the dials we agreed to with the governor on this, not 100%, but the governor's office and the position in this bill is where we a lot of kind of started from with Representative Nadeau, and I was the co-author on those the bills. So I would ask for a yes vote. It is good work. It is lean. It is straightforward. And thank you, members.
Thank you, Chair Beck. I will turn to fiscal staff, Ms. Adrians, for explanation of the fiscal impacts of this bill.
Mr. Chair and members, you have in your packets a spreadsheet, and if you would like a thorough walkthrough of the spreadsheet, our expert, Ms. Stern, is here and would be happy to do so. But I can mention that the overall impact of this bill is in the first biennium for fiscal years 26 and 27. There is a savings that's generated of just over $2 million. And then in the 2028 and 2029 biennium, there is a savings to the general fund of almost $98 million.
Thank you for that. With that, we will turn to member questions. Representative Mueller has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions are in relation to page 50 to 51. The citizenship requirements, and the way I understand how this works is under current law before HR 1, eligible for medical assistance eligibility included citizens and then qualified non-citizens. And so those non-citizens included things like people who were granted asylum, people who are determined to be battered non-citizens, victims of trafficking. And so my understanding is that under HR 1 and then what we're doing with this bill is we're removing Medicaid coverage for those people. And I'm wondering if someone can answer that question.
Chair Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mueller. You are exactly correct. There have been wide swaths of people who have been previously covered with Medicaid who will no longer receive coverage.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that is extremely disappointing. We're talking about victims of torture. We're talking about victims of gender-based violence, domestic assault. We are talking about victims of human trafficking that are going to get denied this coverage. I don't think we can pretend for one second that this federal administration cares about victims of crime. So if they say they do, don't let them. I also reject the notion that we're required to fall in line, as the co-author said here. I understand the need to do this for financial reasons right now, but all of us have a voice and could have, and some of us did, push back on HR 1 when it was being proposed in Congress. Last year, many of us said We are really worried about the things coming down from the federal administration and what that means to Minnesotans. And we sort of were met with, well, don't look up, it hasn't happened yet. It has happened now, it's horrible, and it's up to each and every one of us to continue speaking out about it and to not, quote, fall in line. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other member questions? Co-Chair Frazier.
No other members?
That's it, you're it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, I didn't have anyone else on this. Chair Noor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to Chair Behrman and Chair Becker for bringing the federal alignment for the HR1. But what I'm seeing here is we've added additional stuff that should not be added in this bill, you know, making sure that we are aligned in a good faith effort by using the guidance that we've been given and also the limits that we're putting in. I can start from Article 3, Section 1, which is the beginning of that conformity. If you look at line 36.8 to 36.11, that is a significant change. I was hoping Chair Scott will have caught up with that because that's a significant violation of Minnesota Statute 13.46 of the welfare data, because you are taking everything within the Department of Employment and Economic Security and using it without the consent of the individual, which is a significant expansion, which is also against the federal rules under 42 CFR 431 and 435. I can go on, but that's a red flag to me that we're able to take the private data and take it as a whole, which is under Minnesota Statute Chapter 116L. How did we get there? And how did the judiciary allow us to allow the changes to completely take the entire chapter of data about individuals' employment and give it to the commissioner without putting some limits? And even ignoring 13.46, which is the welfare data, which the agency has already authorized.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Behrman.
That's a good question, Chair Noor, which I think we need to flag that and look at this as we go into conference and have some more discussion about that. I'm not sure directly at this moment if that is part of the requirement of HR1. I suspect that it does have something to do with that alignment and the granting of certain data points across many aspects of people's lives and using it to determine eligibility going forward in this bill.
I'd like to also comment, if I may, Chair.
Chair Becker.
You know, I'm fairly sure, and again, like Co-Chair Behrman talked about, we'll look into it further, but the agencies are allowed to exchange and limit some subset of data for allowing them so they can administer federal benefit programs. So that's what I understand.
A follow-up, Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is not the norm. I think if you look at Chapter 13.46, clearly the welfare data is defined and what is allowable under that section. So I think we need to be looking at that. And also, I'm looking at the 45 days rather than the one-month look back. I don't know how we came up with 45 days. The option in the guidance said 2 months or 1 month. Now we are having a different number, which is completely different than what the guidance states. How did we get there to a number that is not even in the options, in the guidance that we were given by CMS?
Chair Becker. Chair Behrman.
Mr. Chair, excellent question, Chair Noor, and that is just a number that we had strenuous disagreements about this issue, and we went back and forth, and we put that on as a placeholder to get it in line in ways. And the determination of whether that will stand, really, we're looking into CMS, whether they will permit it. It's going to create more work for counties to do that and for DHS. And I'm not certain that it can be done other than you can start out with a 40-day, but I have also read and heard that after 45 days, you need to get on the normal schedule of monthly dates, but it was a sticking point. And the governor is 30, and I hope we'll get there too, because it would be more work for the departments to do to work with that.
Chair Beck.
Yeah, it gave a range in the bill. There was nothing in the that came from the federal government that limited to 45 or 44 or 60 days there, Chair Knorr. Good question. And the department needs to set up a system. Saying that they haven't done it in the past is no different, in my opinion, saying an infant hasn't walked, so they can't walk. So it is something that we will be having the conversation on, but the chief author of the bill, and I would agree with the chief author, which is representing the DOE, it did not say you couldn't do it that, and it was a placeholder so we could keep this moving forward.
Other member questions? Representative Nora, another follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going through the lines, I can go line by line. I think the question that we have is this bill is more prescriptive. We're giving guidance in almost everything without giving room for the agency to reflect what they in alignment with the federal requirement. Even looking at the requirement that we have to look at the SNAP program employment as part of the process, which is line 46.9, it looks into the SNAP employment program. But we're ignoring even the MFIP employment, which should also be qualifying under that section. So if we're going to be more prescriptive on which sections that we're going to be pulling on, it's going to be very difficult for the agency to administer. Looking also into the technology needs for us to be able to be in compliance, we haven't put a lot of resources for the counties. We haven't put resources for even the state to also start addressing the challenges with HR1. So I think this needs more work, and I'm hoping that we can collectively come together to make sure that we have got a bill that is ready so that we don't get sanctioned by the federal government.
Any other comments from the co-chairs?
I would just say one thing, and I agree with Representative Knorr. The counties and the state, when it comes to tech, is way behind. It's no different than at the end of a semester in college. Sometimes you're pushed to get the work done, and this may be the thing that pushes for the state to update the stuff that they need. I think we have agreed that there are things that the state needs for tools, and this may be the thing that pushes us over the edge. So good point. Thank you.
Chair Bierman.
Just a comment that I'd like to find another state that has picked out 45 days or this odd number. What's provided is in the guidance is months, not days. So we'll try to fix this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Rep. Bierman. Thank you, Rep. Backer, for working on this together. Rep. Bierman, thank you for your frank and explicit and open and honest comments about what this will do, what this bill will do with aligning us with H.R. 1. I want to bring it back to these are people that will be harmed by this. We are currently in the midst of a conversation to save our Level 1 Trauma Center safety net hospital because of the financial strains that they have. This will create more uncompensated care, which means that it will create a bigger burden on that hospital, but more so it will create a larger burden on some of our smaller hospitals around the state. We have lost some of those hospitals already, and now we're being asked and forced to have a larger burden on more of those hospitals. This alignment with HR1 is we're being forced to, and I would say in many ways as hostages, we're being forced to do the dirty work of the federal administration here. And I say that as a matter of fact, that's what we're being forced to do here. And I believe it should be in our best interest to do everything that we can to lessen the harm that is gonna be done here. I know I will not be voting for this bill, and Mr. Chair asked for a roll call. I will not be voting for this bill. I know it will move on. But I am hoping that we can do more in terms of harm reduction as the conversation continues on. But this is, we are being held hostage and we are being forced to do the dirty work of administration that does not seem to care about the harm that this will do to many individuals, not only in this state, but around this country. We have a one of the best medical systems in the state, in the country right now. We're being forced to be less than that. We will be forced to be less than that if we accept all of these alignments here. And I have deep concerns about that. And I know the rest of the state does, and my committee members do here as well. And I believe all of the committee members here have deep concerns about that, because we will all be impacted by this.
I will renew the motion that House File 4466, as amended, be referred to the General Register. Roll call has been requested. CLA will take the roll.
Chair Torkelson.
Yes.
Chair Frazier.
No.
Vice Chair Scott.
Yes.
Vice Chair Agbeje.
No.
Representative Akam.
No.
Representative Backer.
Yes.
Representative Baker.
Aye.
Representative Bierman.
Yes.
Representative Gomez.
No.
Representative Heintzman.
Yes.
Representative Igo.
Igo, aye.
Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne, no.
Representative Cagle.
No.
Representative Katiza Watoon.
No.
Representative Kosnick.
Yes.
Representative Kreisha.
Kreisha, yes.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, no.
Representative Moeller.
No.
Representative Nash.
Yes.
Representative Knorr.
No, no.
Representative Novotny.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Pinto.
No.
Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Representative Swedzinski.
Swedzinski, aye. Swedzinski, aye.
Representative Vang.
No.
Representative West.
Aye.
Representative Joachim.
No.
There being 15 ayes and 13 nays, House File 4466, as amended, is passed and to be referred to the General Register. Next up, we have Representative Knorr.
This one, and 47.
Cool.
And 729. And that's the Senate file.
And that's the Senate file. Okay, members, and Chair Knorr, we have a little bit of gymnastics to go through this with this bill, so bear with me. First, I will move that Senate file 476 come before the committee. And then I will move that that file, Senate File 476, be laid over temporarily. Next, I will move that House File 729 come before the committee. And we have an amendment to 729, the A15. Chair Knorr, would you care to describe the A15 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A15 is a technical amendment in nature. The first section is a language that was already agreed to through the judiciary on the personnel data protection for DCT employees. That is also an extension in Article 2 for technical changes in direct care and treatment. We also have some changes on grants that were extended, Mr. Chair. on the other section, and then we have got some changes on assisted living standards and training, particularly for safety, that was included after getting the agreement from all the stakeholders. Mr. Chair, there are also additional technical changes that have been included. We're deleting items that have got cost in the bill, which is in Article 3 and 4, so that we can move those in the finance bill. Basically, those are the key changes in the A15, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Chair Knorr. Any comments to the A15? Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd ask for your support.
Mr. Chair.
Any member questions to the A15 amendment? We do have a technical oral amendment to the A15 amendment. Mr. Sullivan.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, my understanding is that Representative Neuer, the author of the A15 amendment, would incorporate the following oral amendment into his amendment, and it's on page 6, line 20, strike 2027, and insert 2028. So as amended, the sentence would read, notwithstanding Minnesota statutes, section 16A.28, subdivision 3, this appropriation is available until June 30th, 2028.
Chair Knorr, any comments to the oral amendment as presented by fiscal staff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. That was just an omission. This is the advisory committee, which is chaired by Chair Baker, and they're still doing the work, so they requested us to extend the timeline to 2028.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. Chair Schumacher, any comments to the oral amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd ask for your support on this amendment as well.
Thank you. We now have the A15 amendment as amended. Any member questions to the A15? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A15 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. The A15 is adopted to House File 729. I now move that 729 be temporarily laid over, and I will bring back the temporarily laid over Senate File 476 before the committee. I will move to amend Senate File 476 by deleting everything after the enacting clause and inserting the language from House File 729 as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Thank you. We now have our bill the way we would like it to be, Senate File 476 as amended. I will turn at this point to our fiscal staff for a... Oh, I suppose I should. Okay. Chair Knorr or Chair Schumacher, who would like to go first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Knorr.
What?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As the conversations are ongoing, I think we have removed every section that had any fiscal impact. So this bill is primarily a policy bill. I just wanted to thank Chair Schumacher for the work that we've done collectively together to get this bill in the shape that is before us, and also the nonpartisan staff, partisan staff, and also committee members. Basically, Mr. Chair, this is a policy bill which covers the Department of Human Services, the Department of Direct Care and Treatment, Department of Health, and it addresses several sections in the bill that are related to those areas. We have some few changes in the maltreatment of vulnerable adults, and also contains sections of miscellaneous policies. In nature, this is a policy bill, which are non-controversial items that were provided from the agency and members, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't add too much more, as this is just a policy-only bill. We sent the bill to Ways and Means to park it to make sure that there was no fiscal implications and took care of that. So let's go to the General Register.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Any member questions? Representative.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I would just like to thank both of you co-chairs for including a no-lift, no-touch agreement. It's really an important provision, and it will, in my opinion, save lives. And our first responders are very happy to see it in the bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other member comments or questions to the bill as amended. Vice Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Knorr, or Schumacher, whichever, on page 10.20 through 11.6, can you tell me where that language came from?
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was the direct and treatment that it came from the stakeholders, particularly the staff who have been impacted. So this is, I believe this section was brought to this was brought to judiciary, and I'm hoping that that was the section that we just made an amendment. I'll double check.
Follow up, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Knorr, do you remember who the bill's author was for this?
The bill author is Representative Frederick.
Okay, so.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That first section that we amended with your previous amendment is not to this section. It was to a different section of the bill. This section right here, Representative Frederick worked on a DE amendment. He came back, and this language was not in it. So this language, I'm not sure where it came from, if he came and amended this into your bill, but it was amended. This was not part of what left our committee and judiciary. This is language that was not part of his bill when it left judiciary.
Chair Knorr.
Mr. Chair, this is, thank you for the reminder. This section that we amended are the ones that came to judiciary. This section is the policy initiative that were brought to us by the agency, and we can always bring them up here in case of any questions. These are the same protocols that they already follow right now under the direct care and treatment. So nothing addition that has been added in this language that is different than the protocols that they have.
Vice Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what happened is this was part of the original bill that Representative Frederick had, and we expressed concerns with that. He came back with the DE2, and this was not in there. So did someone have a separate bill just for this language?
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We had a separate bill that was presented in the Human Services that contained all the elements of direct care and treatment policy.
Vice Chair Scott.
Thank you. So who was the author of that?
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Frederick was the chief author of the bill.
Vice Chair Scott.
Okay, so I'm concerned and puzzled that this language was added back in after it was basically taken out in his DE in the Judiciary Committee. And now we see it inserted back in. That's troubling to me. We have a committee process, and maybe it's bad on me for not catching that when it went through your committee and it was added back in. But this is disturbing to me. I thought, you know, a deal was a deal around here, but maybe that's not the case, but I'm just, it doesn't feel right to me, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Scott. Any other member questions or comments to the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Chair Knorr.
Just for clarity, we had two different bills. The original one was the DCT policy bill, direct care and treatment, and then the other bill that went to judiciary. So I think that's the confusion, and those are two separate, and if we want nonpartisan staff to clarify that, we can get that clarity.
Chair Scott.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and that makes another point that this section didn't come then to our committee, and it deals with the Health Records Act, which deals with data, which our committee looks at. It's the reason that that bill, the Frederick's bill, came to our committee in the first place. So it just feels wrong. It feels like something was done, you know, that was, I don't like using in the dark of night, but it just doesn't feel right to me, Mr. Chair, and I I would hope that we can have a further discussion on this to the two chairs at the table, because, yeah, there was a reason that it was concerning in the first place.
Thank you, Vice Chair Scott. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you. I'm just asking for a little bit of clarification, if you'll indulge me, Mr. Chair. So are we talking about lines 10.24 through 10.27?
Vice Chair Scott.
Thank you. So 10.20 to 11.6. Okay. That's all language that should have been heard in judiciary but was not.
Chair Claiborne.
Thank you. And my confusion is it says, unless specifically required to do so by Minnesota or federal law. I just don't understand the concern of that language being in a separate bill, because you could add HI, and those could be in a separate bill. I'm just confused as to why that would need to go to judiciary, and that you and I can have that conversation. Representative Scott, I'm just trying to understand, truly understand your concern. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Claiborne. Any other member questions or comments? With that, renew the motion.
Renew the motion to Section 46 as amended.
I will renew the motion that Senate File 476 as amended be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. The bill is moved to the General Register. Thank you, chairs. At this point, we are going to recess this committee pending further negotiations on the remainder of the agenda. We will let you know as soon as possible if we intend to reconvene. If we do not intend to reconvene, we'll also let you know that. Make sure these materials are saved for these last three bills so that we don't lose them. And I look forward to seeing you sometime later today. I have no idea when. A question.
Mr. Chair, no. I just wanted to request that the bills that we didn't hear, that we reserve them so that we don't have to reprint them again.
Yes, that's what I just tried to say. I maybe didn't say it clear enough. But
all right, thank you.
Please preserve the bills that are yet to come. Thank you for your attendance. We'll be in contact soon. I will call the Ways and Means Committee back into order. We have we are going to hear one more bill this evening. There was some mix-up as to how many bills we might hear. It'll just be the one bill, Senate File 856, and I will move Senate File 856, second unofficial engrossment before the committee, to be moved to the General Register. We have a series of amendments that we are going to go through first. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first amendment I would like to move would be the A14.
Representative Claiborne moves the A14 amendment. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you. And in honor of the agreement, I would like to divide this amendment, please. And I would like to only consider lines 1.5 through 1.9.
Representative Claiborne moves to divide the amendment. I agree that the amendment is divisible, and we will consider of the A14 amendment, we will now consider lines 1.5 through 1.9. Chair Claiborne.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And what this amendment would do would add $15 million in fiscal 2027 from the general fund to the Office of Inspector General for technology modernization to improve data sharing between the agencies and to enhance security, identity authentication, and verification capabilities for the state services. This is a one-time appropriation, which would be available to June 30, 2030. It's an important part. I noticed in the bill that there are no provisions for IT, and if we are going to do this work well, we should be including IT appropriations.
Any member questions or comments? Representative Gomez.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if this is, if this actually, because it's, there are a number of kind of functions for this $15 million that I'm seeing. This first one, technology modernization to improve data sharing between agencies. I mean, that alone, as my understanding is that that's a very costly prospect. And then there are these other, security enhancement, identity authentication. I'm just wondering if this, and the chair brought forward or has been discussing, sort of like much broader IT modernization. I'm just wondering if this is an adequate amount of money for what's laid out here, or if this is sort of like part, we're all kind of, we're in Ways and Means, we're trying to figure out what's the cost moving forward. Is this like step one, or is this it? Or maybe you don't know.
Chair Claiborne.
Thank you very much, Chair Gomez. I appreciate the question. In the 2023 budget for state government, we did, across the enterprise, put in a great deal of money for IT modernization. But in the fiscal note for this particular bill, it outlines the very specific needs of IT that will be needed for this office to do its job effectively. And in the governor's proposal, IT came and testified in state government what the $15 million would do, and it seemed appropriate for that conversation. So that's where the $15 million came from. And, Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call on this, please.
Roll call requested. Roll call granted. Other member questions? Any comments from the authors of the bill?
I'll comment quick. Everything that is in the bill, including the amendment that Representative Norris is offering that we've agreed to, has been discussed in depth and debated by the working group, including the Senate. And the Senate has said they will concur with things because we've essentially conferenced this before. This is something new. It doesn't mean it's necessarily a good or a bad idea, but we don't want to do anything with this bill before it's completely agreed to with the Senate. So I would ask that that we not put amendments on that have been not completely and totally vetted with the working group. There is still time before this is on the floor, I suspect, next week. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. So, Representative Claiborne, I have been working hard on technology modernization, as you know. I'd be happy to bring this into our conversation. But at this point in time, with this bill and the delicate negotiations and the long process that we have been through, much of which you are directly familiar with, I'm going to suggest that we not accept this amendment, even though I care very much about technology modernization and realize how important it is. But as Greg Davids would say, today is not the day. The CA will take the roll.
Chair Torkelson.
Chair votes no.
Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Scott.
No.
Vice Chair Egbadje.
Aye.
Representative Acom.
Aye.
Representative Backer.
No.
Representative Baker.
No.
Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Representative Gomez.
Aye.
Representative Heintzman.
No.
Representative Igo.
I don't know.
Representative Claiborne.
Claiborne, aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
You are no on this.
Representative Cagle.
What? Again. Oh, aye.
Representative Katisa-Watun.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Kreisha?
Go ahead, Ron.
Kreisha, no.
Representative Lilly?
Lilly, aye.
Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Representative Nash?
Nope.
Representative Noor?
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
No.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Representative Swedzinski?
Thanks. Swedzinski, no.
Representative Vang?
No.
Aye. Representative West?
No.
Representative Joachim?
Yes.
There being 14 ayes and 14 nays, the amendment as divided, considering lines 1.5 through 1.9, is not adopted. Chair Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next, I offer the A15. I move the motion for the A15 to be before us. The A15 needs to be a bit modified at this particular time, and I've talked to House Nonpartisan about this because the base amount will be changed in the amendment being offered by Representative Norris. The intent of this motion is to add $12,500,000 per year to build out the office and staff of the Inspector General Anti-Fraud Waste Bureau. This is the law enforcement unit that is referenced in the bill. If we are going to set this office up to do its work, then we need to be honest about what it costs, and we need to fund the law enforcement unit. And we have estimated in the fiscal note that the high end will be $12,500,000 per year. And that is, I would like to be able to give House Nonpartisan the ability to adjust it appropriately after passage of the amendment to add the $12.5 million per year to the appropriation.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just point out that as this bill was leaving state government after its fourth attempt to get it out, none of these amendments were offered. And that would have been a great time to talk about this very thing. We didn't. And now we're talking about it in Ways and Means. So I think that, for me, that will give me the ability to vote no.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Chair Claiborne.
Thank you. I would like to remind my co-chair and the members of this committee who were not maybe enjoying state government as much as we did that, in fact, we offered a House position, a DE, which was not considered, and therefore our amendments were all turned down. So this is the appropriate place. This is Ways and Means. We are seeing the bill in its final form as it's passing to go to the floor, and it is more than appropriate to put in the funding as we see the bill moving forward.
All those in favor of the A16 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
No, the bill, the amendment does not pass.
Next, I would like
Chair
to
offer. Chair Claiborne.
Thank you very much. I would like to offer and move before the committee the A17.
One moment, Representative Claiborne. I don't think I mentioned the number of the amendment in my last statement. I want to make sure everything is clear.
Do you mean I could still ask for a roll call?
The A15 does not pass. Chair Claiborne.
Thank you very much. Now we have the A17 before the committee. And the A17 adds an important duty to the tasks of the Office of the Inspector General. And it's to establish appropriate prepayment review procedures for all agencies. And that is what the amendment would do. And I will ask for a roll call.
Representative Nash.
Once again, Mr. Chair, we didn't see a House position. We saw a House DFL position offered in my committee, Chair Claiborne's co-committee. We had a House position as the bill left, which is largely what we see in front of us, and I think there's going to be a minor tweak to it here and there, but this is not a quote-unquote House position that my co-chair is offering. It is a House DFL position.
Thank you, Chair Nash. Seeing no other discussion, we will proceed to the roll call vote as requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Torkelson.
No.
Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Scott.
No.
Vice Chair Agbaje.
Aye.
Representative Akam.
Aye.
Representative Backer.
No.
Representative Baker.
Nope.
Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Representative Gomez.
Aye.
Representative Heintzman.
No.
Representative Igo.
Igo, no.
Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Katiza-Watoon.
Katiza-Watoon, aye.
Representative Kosnick.
No.
Representative Krisha.
Krisha, no.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Moeller.
Thanks.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Noor.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
No.
Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Representative Swazinski.
Swazinski, no.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative West.
No.
Representative Joachim.
Aye.
There being 14 ayes and 14 nays, the amendment fails. The A-17 amendment is not adopted. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And this, I would move the A-25 to be before the committee.
Chair Cleavorn moves the A-25 amendment. Chair Cleavorn.
Thank you very much. And this would establish a new coordinating commission. And the purpose of this coordinating commission would be for the Inspector General Coordinating Committee to coordinate and strengthen the work of the executive branch agencies in safeguarding public resources through effective and efficient program integrity, audit procedures, internal controls, and related functions. The amendment lays out who would be able to participate. It would be a commissioner or designee from each agency. That has its own inspector general, and it would also be the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension in the Department of Public Safety, the commissioner of admin or their designee from the Office of Grants Management, the commissioner of management and budget, specifically their internals, controls, and accountability unit, and they would meet monthly to share investigative data, trends, and other information that would better prevent, detect, and investigate fraud and misuse in agency programs. They would also assist the Inspector General in the development of data sharing methods, investigative best practices, program integrity review processes across the agency's programs. It would also assist agencies in securing specialized internal audits, investigation, and other necessary skills and tools. All the things that we know that help prevent fraud, it would be what the things that this new coordinating commission would work on, and I would ask for a roll call, please.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of my favorite quotes that my co-chair has heard me say many times, it's from Oscar Wilde, and it's, the bureaucracy is expanding to meet the needs of the expanding bureaucracy. I
can't wait to answer that one.
Well, I look forward to it. It'll be like old home week. I just think that, once again, this is outside of the working group. This is not something that they brought forward. The deal is perhaps quite tenuous, and I think that this is something that we should not do.
Thank you. Chair Nash, Chair Cleavorn, I'm tempted to call this amendment out of order. This is a fiscal committee, and this is a policy amendment, but I will allow it to go forward. Chair Cleavorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And because this amendment would enable us to develop policies and procedures that would save money, I do think that it is relevant to the committee. And I would just like to say, anyone who has read this bill understands the duplication that is occurring in this bill. It duplicates things that are already being done in the OLA. It duplicates things that are already happening in the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. It duplicates things that are already happening in MMB. It is the very definition of expanding government at a very expensive cost. I will agree with everybody in this committee that fraud is something that has to be rooted out and ended and prosecuted to the fullest extent possible. No fraud is acceptable. But to say that my amendment of having a commission of state employees coming together to talk about best practices is expanding government is laughable, absolutely laughable. But the work that they can do in breaking down the silos and preventing fraud and sharing best practices and sharing what they're seeing in the attempts at fraud against their agencies is really vital and important. And I can't remember if I asked for a roll call, but I do want a roll call. Thank you.
So, Chair Claiborne, I have a question for you.
Please
what
ask.
In state law prevents state employees from discussing these matters without direction from the legislature?
You know, it's a really good question. I don't know that there is prevention, but I can tell you that oftentimes you and I have seen over the years the task force that we have brought together to get people to share best practices and talk about it. And sometimes requiring them to get together on a monthly basis builds the relationships that allow people to share data and develop best practices together. When people are busy with their work and doing their job on a day-to-day basis, they might not think about what's happening in another But bringing them together on a monthly basis really does build those relationships, and it does facilitate information sharing, and it is a vital, vital part of government.
Seeing no more member questions, the roll will be taken on the A25 amendment.
Chair Torkelson.
No.
Chair Frazier.
Chair Frazier. Aye.
Vice Chair Scott.
No.
Vice Chair Igbajay.
Aye.
Representative Akam.
Aye.
Representative Backer.
No.
Representative Baker.
No.
Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Representative Gomez.
Aye.
Representative Heintzman.
No.
Representative Igo.
Igo, no.
Representative Claiborne.
Claiborne, aye.
Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Katisa Watoon.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
No.
Representative Kreshaw.
Kreshaw, no.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Noor.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
No.
Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Representative Swazinski.
Swazinski, no.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative West.
No.
Representative Joachim.
Aye.
There being 14 ayes and 14 nays, the A25 is not adopted. Representative Chair Claiborne. No more?
You get a break tonight.
Don't you call. Oh, clever. To the bill, we do have an amendment that we are going to adopt. We have the A36 amendment to your amendment, Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson and members. It's good to be with you this evening. It's a later than usual convening of this committee, but we're here for a good reason, and that's because we have good news. We have an agreement that has been reached on the OIG bill. This has been a lengthy process, but a good process. We started with two different bills, and through a lot of hard work by folks on both sides of the aisle in both the House and the Senate, we were able to eventually work our way toward one bill and over time narrow down the list of remaining sticking points. We came before you about 10 days ago and said that we were close. We had a few remaining sticking points to work through, and we continue to work diligently together. And I'm happy to share that the A36 amendment that is before you this evening reflects an agreement that resolves some of the remaining sticking points with the bill.
Excuse me, Representative Norris, I apparently did not properly move the amendment. I want to make sure I do my work properly. The chair moves that the A36 be before the committee and considered for adoption. Go ahead with your statement.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. And now that the amendment has been appropriately moved, it's appropriate to get into what's actually in the amendment. First, fittingly for Ways and Means, it includes the appropriation language for the bill. It funds both the office itself as well as some additional funding for some of the state agencies that will have additional duties and responsibilities in complying with what's in the bill. There's also a bunch of kind of what we're calling miscellaneous cleanup items that, as we've continued to go through the bill with a fine-tooth comb, we've identified, and so those are cleaned up in this amendment as well. We also address the law enforcement issue in this amendment. One of the things that we've done to address that is it still retains the ability, the office still retains the ability to create a law enforcement agency. However, that authority does not take effect until January 1st, 2028. In the meantime, the office will have the ability to work with the BCA through an interagency agreement for any law enforcement needs that they have. I kind of bill that as a test driving the model of working with the BCA to see how that works and whether there's actually a need to create a separate law enforcement agency in the future. So that's how we dealt with the law enforcement component. And then I will turn it over to my co-author on the bill, who has been great in working through all of these issues with over the last, 16 months now we've been at it? She'll describe some of the additional components of this amendment.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think the other big issue that was sort of a sticking point for a long time is the issue of the MDE, the current staff, OIG staff within there. This amendment essentially allows or says that the OIG, the statewide OIG, will embed those staff within the agency. This is common. It was something that I actually did myself when I was state auditor back when we had a larger staff at that time, and we embedded folks within Ramsey County. We had a whole department there, and they were state auditor employees, but they actually focused 100% on Ramsey County. We had that in Minneapolis, too. And so it's a way to, frankly, come to a compromise where these folks who will be statewide OIG employees, but they will also be within focus 100% on MDE issues, the ones that are within MDE. So they will have that expertise, and I think it was a good compromise, and that's what we came to. And I think the rest we went over, there's some just minor things. I can tell you, I know the legislative auditor was brought up again. The legislative auditor and staff has been through this bill about 20 times. And so, some of these are little minor things. There is no duplication of duties with the legislative auditor. And it's an excellent bill. It was an excellent compromise. It was a long process, but we're good, and the Senate is good. And that's the key. This is a bill that all four caucuses, both bodies, are behind, and it's something that is greatly needed for the state of Minnesota. So thank you.
Representative Mueller has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this, maybe it's to the bill, not necessarily to the amendment. I can wait and ask my
question. Is to the amendment.
Yeah, sorry, Mr. Chair, I'll wait till the bill.
Thank you. Any member questions to the amendment as presented? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A36 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Your bill is adopted. The A36 is adopted to Senate File 856. To the bill as adopted, Representative Norris.
Chair Tolgerson, we might have some wrap-up remarks, but I don't think we have anything further to add in the interest
of time. All right. Well, let's go to member questions then. Representative Morrow. I can talk. Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have questions about Section 8 of the bill, which is the law enforcement powers beginning on line 11.3. I think it's unfortunate that this did not come before the Public Safety Committee because I have a lot of questions about this. My first question is what is meant by abuse on line 11.9? Because it says the primary jurisdiction of the agency is limited to offenses involving fraud, abuse, and any other criminal conduct. So what abuse? Can you point me to a statute, please, that refers to?
Representative Norris.
Yeah. Chair Torkelson, Chair Mueller, it's a good question. That was one of those technical cleanups that we accomplished in the amendment that was just adopted. That word abuse was changed to misuse, which is a defined term in the bill.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, may I? Mm-hmm.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you. Where in statute is there a crime of misuse?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mueller, Chair Mueller, as we were discussing this the whole time, there were terms using like waste, fraud, and abuse. We thought the better term is misuse of funds, and we made that decision to use that term all throughout this bill. Misuse. And I think that in a lot of the fraud legislation that's going through, we've been using that term misuse. So that is why it's in here. Again, that was caught as one of the final technical things by staff, and we changed that to misuse.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, let me just say, I really appreciate all the work you all have done working on this. So I'm just truly trying to understand this because I think if it had come to public safety, we could have maybe defined this a little bit more and to have actual crimes that are referenced here, especially when this is so broad and says any other criminal conduct. So I'm just a little concerned, and maybe there's some time still to sort of tighten up some of those terms or at least reference certain statutes. And then on line 11.11 to 11.13, it says that the Bureau may respond to requests to exercise law enforcement duties in cooperation with the agency with jurisdiction. Would that include the federal government?
Representative Norris.
Chair Torkelson, we're going to defer to nonpartisan staff on that, if possible.
Would you like the question repeated, nonpartisan staff, or are you prepared to answer?
Mr. Chair and members, I think I can give it a shot here. Law enforcement agency, as used in this context on 11.13, is not defined. I would need to look. There is a reference to a definition of law enforcement agency on 11.6. But it's not clear that that applies to law enforcement agency as used on 11.13. If it would be helpful, I can look up that definition, 626.84, subdivision 1, paragraph F.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I also, the entire law enforcement section, the original, was written by Senator Latz in the Senate. I just want you to, and you to be aware, and was through judiciary numerous times. So this was
Chair
not
Mueller.
Written by us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate that, but he and I don't always see eye to eye.
Okay.
Respectfully, but so maybe we can get an answer to that question, and I can ask another one. So if this does end up going into effect, and I do appreciate that it's been pushed out for a while, whose budget would this law enforcement piece come from? Is it the public safety budget?
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, and Chair Mueller. The law enforcement piece could start in about 2 years from now, essentially, because the OIG isn't going to be appointed until next year, probably February of next year. The law enforcement piece starts about a year later, and before that time, this body, which I will not be a member of, will be setting a budget for this amongst other agencies. So this would be new money for the law enforcement entity, and it will be the next legislature's decision how this is funded. I think in talking to, there was fiscal notes, potentially ranges that were laid out. Understand it would be only 18 months of that next budget period at the most. In talking to my own talks in law enforcement, it would not be $12 million either. You know, they could do this for, 15 people at the most. But that is a decision this next legislature will make. So,
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I mean, presumably that since the BCA is doing this type of work now, these investigations, though, they wouldn't be doing it anymore? Are you envisioning that the BCA would continue to do their work in their fraud unit and this would be going simultaneously?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative. Right now, the BCA, with the governor's executive order, and then we changed that last year, there is a fraud unit within the BCA. As you know, 75% of what they do has to be insurance fraud. And so they're just starting to do some of this other work. Most of the fraud that's been prosecuted has been done by the feds here in the state. It's been done by the U.S. Attorney's Office, and because it's been Medicare related and so on. The things can be sent to the BCA. We had a CCAP, I'm on the fraud committee, we had a CCAP hearing or a hearing on CCAP yesterday, and I think they've had just 3 or 4 cases a year have been sent on to law enforcement just in that one. And so just to put it into perspective, it hasn't been much so far. So this will be a decision that will be made by the inspector general, how to handle that. In the short term, there'll be an interagency agreement between the Office of Inspector General, which again is about a year away from now when it's actually set up, and the BCA, and they will do that together. We wanted to give the Inspector General, who should be an expert in their field, we wanted to give them, some ability to do this how they think it makes sense, too. So,
thank you. Representative Mullen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think if nonpartisan has an answer to that, and I'll just say, too, the Medicaid fraud prosecutions happen at the Attorney General's office too, and they do really good work with that. So just wanted to make sure that was pointed out. Does nonpartisan have an answer?
I will find out for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sullivan, do you have an answer to the previous question?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Mueller. So the reference to 626.84, that is statute that governs the post board. And the law enforcement agencies and officers that are subject to post board oversight. So it means a unit of state or local government authorized by law to grant full powers of arrest and to charge a person, or the law enforcement agency of a federally recognized tribe. So again, that definition clearly applies to the IG's authority to establish a law enforcement agency. I would say it's not entirely clear to your question on 11.13 if that same definition applies there. I think it would be more clear if the intent was to limit the cooperation to state and local and tribal law enforcement agencies, that it would be appropriate to once again reference 626.84 subdivision 1 paragraph F on 11.13.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Chair Mueller, anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know this, agreement was worked on by many people over a lot of time. I just really wish this had come to the Public Safety Committee, because I think some of these things could have been ironed out, and I'm not going to be supporting it at this time, but again, appreciate your work.
Chair Uwacking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to echo the thanks for all the work you both have done. I know this has been a very long journey, and I'm glad we finally have a stamp, at least have some input from the House and not just taking other bodies' bills. As you can see, there had been some issues with that. I still have concerns over the sections around removing the MDE. Just to remind folks, we talked about this briefly. They stood up their office in under 2 years. They've investigated, had 412 complaints, 178 complaints were closed, 234 are still under investigation. 21 investigations were in collaboration with law enforcement and had 20 temporary sanctions imposed, saving $1.1 million already and recovering over $12,000 to start with, but there's more on the way. They've been doing items that other agencies have been wanting to do around using AI to enable review of documents, doing a lot of prevention work on the front end. And this language, while you keep and you embed OIG in MDE, so there will be some knowledge base there, but there's some work that needs to be done on lining this up and on timing, because you remove all the funding from the MDE for the OIG staff, but then the statewide OIG only provides investigative duties and none of the preventative duties. So now the OIG and MD doesn't have any ability to do any of the prevention to prevent the fraud before it happens. And then you also leave MDE with less power to do sanctions if something is found wrong. So I hope you'll continue to work on this. I mean, there's a reason why we put OIG and MDE. It's the second largest funding stream in the whole state, and we do deal with federal funds as well. So I think we probably should have an OIG there that is actually fully embedded, not just embedded in MDE, but has MDE staff there. So I think there's still some work to do in lining those dates up and lining the sanctions up and still giving MDE the ability to do the prevention work that they had been doing in the office that's currently there. So I'm still thinking about whether or not I can support it today.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted some clarity on federal Medicaid compliance because of the requirement for single state agency to be responsible. In this instance, we're giving the Commission of Human Services to be the sole authority for the Medicaid. It seems that this bill conflicts with that authority when it says the IG may be able to investigate Medicaid fraud. And that is permissive for that IG to do so. But this kind of conflicts with the single state agency requirement. How are we going to be able to, I understand we're asking CMS for approval, which means we may have that conflict because the federal rule specifically says single state agency. How are we going to resolve that issue?
Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson, and thank you for the question, Chair Knorr. We spent a lot of time as a working group with nonpartisan staff, getting technical assistance from the agencies on this, and you're right. We ultimately are asking CMS for approval and sign-off on this to be doubly sure that everything is going to be okay and we're not putting federal dollars at risk. I think the main way that we address that is starting on line 9.12, where, for instance, the Department of Human Services has primary responsibility to investigate fraud in the Medicaid program. So they will be that lead sole agency. The centralized IG would have concurrent authority to conduct independent investigations related to Medicaid if they would like. But to fulfill that statutory requirement at the federal level, this language puts the primary responsibility on the Department of Human Services. We've worked extensively with nonpartisan staff on that, and I think we feel comfortable that this addresses it in a satisfactory manner. But again, we did put that comfort language in about getting the CMS approval to make sure.
Representative Nora, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple of follow-up quickly. So under the Minnesota statute, we have 256.01 subdivision 1 specifically gives this authority to the Commission of Human Service. I don't see any change in the statute. We also have 256B.04 subdivision 1 also. So if you go through that whole process of even the sanction process, 256B.04 subdivision 2, all that authority has been, you know, delegated to the Commission of Human Services. The way that this is drafted, it's permissive for the Inspector General to do the investigation, which is now in conflict. But it also, as you're aware of, if there's any credible allegation, the same channels require that within 24 hours there's a referral to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit within the Attorney General, which this bill does not follow that authority. I understand we do have part of the amendment saying that Mfuku is the main entity, but it kind of conflicts. There's a lot of conflict what is supposed to be happening. And then likewise, I think if there's a report to the legislative auditor, right now it says the legislative auditor will have to transfer all that information to the Inspector General. Likewise, it's an either or of how you're going to be reporting, whether you go to the legislative auditor or the Inspector General. So there's a lot of conflicting terms here, which I don't want us to say somebody else was supposed to do this work, so we didn't do it. And that's what I'm worried about, because now we're transferring responsibilities in different places, but we may end up having the unintended consequences of who was responsible for what. I don't know if you can help me make sure that there isn't that conflict. At the same time, some of the issues we have with the Medicaid process under the federal rules.
Yeah.
Representative Norris.
Chair Torkelson and Chair Noor, I think it's a good question. In terms of speaking broadly, it is something we talked about as a working group where you've got multiple people with responsibility. Is there a situation where, you know, something falls through the cracks or everybody assumes that somebody else is going to take responsibility? I think that's why we said that we chose the language of primary responsibility. So, you know, my expectation would be that the agency, whether in this case, you know, Department of Human Services, Department of Children, Youth, and Families, if something comes within their purview that they believe needs to be investigated, qualifies for something that should be investigated, they've got the primary responsibility and they should be the ones to initiate that investigation. Unless there's an intentional conversation with the central IG and there's a decision to hand it off, what this simply allows is the Inspector General to do that concurrent investigation if they wish, that would be supplementary to the investigation that one of those agencies is doing. With regard to any specific conflicts with existing law, I would probably defer to House Research on those specific questions, and it's certainly something we could go through with them offline as well, you know, if you've got specific concerns, Chair Noor, to make sure that there aren't any unintended conflicts with existing state law.
Representative Noor.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. I think we had the legislative auditor loud and clear that there are existing conflicts in the work that they do versus the work that we're assigning to the independent inspector general. And before I go too far, I think there's a section that specifically I was looking to read it before the law enforcement area. I'll ask nonpartisan to point that where there's either or, that you can refer the cases to either the Inspector General or the legislative auditor.
Thank you. While you're looking, are you done, Representative Norm?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll follow up if I find that section.
I've got it, Mr. Chair.
Nonpartisan, Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Noor, I believe you're referring to Section 16, which is on the bottom of page 18. It's an existing section in the Criminal Code, Chapter 609. I think there's probably some confusion in the language as drafted right now, a conflict arguably between the header on 18.26, Legislative Auditor or Inspector General. But the language itself, which would control in this case on 18.31, says the there's the duty to promptly report to both the legislative auditor and the statewide inspector general.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Does that answer your question, Representative Norm?
Technically, yes, Mr. Chair. So if you read that process, is if there's any problem that for any state agency, University of Minnesota, or other organization listed under 3.971, that the report will have to go to both legislative auditor and also the inspector general. And that seems to be more broad-based. Why do we need both if we have two agencies that are doing the same thing?
Is that a question to the author, Representative Norm?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
University of Minnesota.
Representative Norris.
Chair Torkelson, Chair Noor, I think the decision of the working group as we were working through that was that both of those entities have responsibilities for investigating instances of fraud or misuse, and so it was appropriate for both agencies or offices to receive those reports. I think one of the challenges is in talking to the legislative auditor, she's indicated that they get more tips than they can fully vet and investigate to the level of detail that they'd like to. And so by referring it to both, we're hoping to increase the capacity we have to look into these sorts of reports and determine whether they're credible and deserve further investigation or turn out to be frivolous.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Norm.
So if you look at Article 1, Section 1, Subdivision 3B, that requires everything that is sent to the legislative auditor must refer all those credit reports to the public, from the public to the IG. Isn't that not now forcing the legislative auditor to turn over everything that they have been referred to? That becomes the de facto now, because they don't have to investigate some and give some to the independent inspector general. That section to me says that everything that the legislative auditor receives must be referred to the independent inspector general. Don't we see that we're just creating another conflict in that whole process?
Yeah. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I fully expect the legislative auditor and the IG to work to get together, to cooperate. And I think that's their intention. The legislative auditor cooperates right now with law enforcement, with the BCA. And I fully expect that will continue. Some things are more audit. They get thousands of complaints. We've had thousands of complaints on our little tip line, in our fraud committee. And some of them would rise to the level of an IG, and some of them are simply things that are at the level of a legislative auditor. So they're more internal controls issues, they're more financial issues within an agency. That's what they're looking at generally. And so we need cooperation amongst the agencies.
Final follow-up, Mr. Chair. I think that is where we see a lot of conflicts, which I noted that who's doing what, because there's nothing that in this legislation says that anything that is sent to the inspector general is sent to the legislative auditor. There's nothing at all in this bill. but it's only one way that everything from legislative auditor will have to be reviewed by the Inspector General. So are we saying that now the Inspector General has got more authority than the legislative auditor in this sense?
Representative Norris.
Do it.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Neither one would have more authority over the other, but ultimately with the law enforcement division within the Inspector General, should that be set up, which is the intention, that they will have duties that the legislative auditor doesn't have. And it's been a problem. You know, we're on the Audit Commission, and the legislative auditor does amazingly good work and has, but besides slapping folks on the wrist, there's nothing that they can do about it. They can just say, here's what we saw, here's the problems, but they can't do anything. They can send things to BCA, and in this case, you know, they can send things to the Inspector General, and the Inspector General can do more. But the intent, there are two different branches of government. The Inspector General is part of the executive branch. The legislative auditor is part of the legislative branch. The IG is not directed by us or anyone, really. The legislative auditor office is directed by the legislature. So they're very different entities with different functions. And we have tried and worked with the legislative auditor for a year and a half and taken almost every one of their changes, their proposed changes, including many that are in with this last amendment. And so we have done absolutely everything we can to make sure that they are very separate and that they're comfortable, that the Legislative Auditor's Office is comfortable with this. So.
Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. Just to tag on real quickly to one of the things Representative Anderson was saying, you know, one of the first debates we had in working on this bill was whether it should be in the legislative branch or the executive branch. And one of the important reasons we decided to ultimately do the executive branch was that ability for them to take more direct and immediate action, more direct and immediate access to the data. The legislative auditor is limited to just making recommendations, whereas by putting this office in the executive branch, they'd actually be able to implement changes, require state agencies to make these sorts of changes if we're seeing patterns or practices that are concerning. So I do think that, you know, they each will play an important but distinct role.
Thank you. Representative Katiza Batum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing a full and thorough discussion of this bill tonight. I think it's really important. I have a quick question. So just reviewing the kind of the fiscal note and some of the sections that are going to impact the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, it is section, it's line 29.9 about submitting investigative reports on child care assistance and fraud and misuse. I spoke with the Department of Children, Youth, and Families and just trying to understand if such a report doesn't actually exist in at this point in time where they are reporting on alleged fraud or actual investigative confirmed fraud or misuse, this would require them to send that report to the Office of the Inspector General. But I'm not seeing any language, and I might just be missing it, that report then would also come to the chairs of the and minority members of ranking members of the committees of jurisdiction.
Representative Norris.
Chair Torkelson, Chair Katiza Watun, just looking at it briefly, I don't see that requirement either. I think it, you know, is an idea that might have some merit, and we could certainly take it under advisement before the bill comes to the floor.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, okay. Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I think, you know, to the extent that we can ensure that the legislature has all related and appropriate information so that we could take legislative action if necessary. I think that that's something that we should definitely consider. And then also just kind of looking at the staffing sections, it's my understanding based on that conversation and based on the fiscal note for the Department of Children, Youth, and Families that they are planning to hire an additional five
staff members to coordinate with the central office of the inspector general. Are we calling that the COIG? I don't know. It's some, you know, shortening the, but I don't know. Just workshopping things here. But I'm not sure, just based on what's listed out in the fiscal note for the staffing of the office of the inspector general, how they are going to assign those folks, those investigators, between either MDH, DHS, DCYF, who already have internal departments of the OIG, and then the other departments that do not have an OIG. Is that something that you would anticipate the departments figuring that out kind of in the data sharing agreement or the interagency agreement, or is that something that you guys have talked about and I'm maybe just oversight here?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Chair Tolkien and Chair. That would be part of an interagency agreement, but I can tell you that in my professional opinion, I think these agencies don't need to hire these people to do this. Okay, so, but we took it, and it's part of the fiscal note. So it just, you know, it is what it is. So, but I don't think what there's in there, like DHS has like 25 or 30 people or something. They've added a whole bunch of staff because they're saying that they're going to have more complaints if there's an inspector general office because the public will have more complaints. That's their argument. So this is what was... this is what fiscal came up with, and we're just accepting it. So,
another follow-up, Representative Katizo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, just a final thought here. I think I take your point, Representative Anderson. I think that's definitely worth considering, and that was part of the reason why I had the conversation with DCYF. Because, but I think you know the idea of standing up a brand new office, as DCYF has just recently done itself. And kind of considering all the additional data analytics and reporting that the centralized OIG may require from the department to make sure that we are preventing and stopping fraud at the source. I think, you know, just making sure that we're staffed appropriately is something that we definitely want to consider. So, and also to avoid any, like, duplicative investigatory roles, which, you know, I think it's good to have a second set of eyes on things at times, but hopefully in that interagency agreement that we talked about, that's how they would kind of iron things out. So appreciate all the work that you've done on this and, you know, look forward to future discussion and partnership.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to both representatives for your work on this. We can flip to page 6, the top of page 6, the definitions of fraud and misuse. And I guess because of the amendment, we're now that term misuse, I think, is kind of carrying through. They seem really broad in some ways. I'm just trying to understand, like, that definition of fraud, is that intended to encompass? I'm assuming it's not intended to encompass, like, an individual who defrauds someone else not involving government programs. Uh-uh. And I can see, yeah, Representative Anderson saying no, but then I'm not sure where the limitation is on that in the bill, if you've got it, you know. And misuse also very broad. So maybe you can just sort of help kind of think through, like, how those definitions flow through and how they kind of are properly grabbing what we're trying to grab.
Representative Norris.
Chair Torkelson and Chair Pinto, it's a good question. I think the main places in the bill where the scope of the centralized OIG's purview is limited or focused is in the powers and duties section, and in particular on page 8, pointing you to item 4, and item 8. Now, item 8 was changed a little bit in the amendment that we adopted this evening, but basically combined, these two sections confine the OIG to looking for fraud or misuse within state executive branch departments and agencies or within public or private recipients of state funds and with some of the language we adopted in the A34, we limit it to only reviewing their proper or improper use of those state funds. So especially as it related to either a private entity, a local unit of government, this office wouldn't have the authority to look at any sort of misuse of, you know, private dollars, or even with the example of a local unit of government, you know, how they use their own property taxes that they levy and collect. It would, the nexus would have to be connected to state funds.
Follow-up, Representative.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. And that's helpful. I do see that quite a few of those clauses do relate to public programs in that way, though not all. I guess I'm noticing, like, Clause 5. I mean, maybe think that Clause 5 is kind of referencing the others as well. It feels like when I look at those definitions of fraud and misuse, it does seem quite broad, especially given the scope of the powers for this and this agency. And maybe just more broadly, I was reflecting on Chair Nash's reference to the Oscar Wilde quote, and kind of that had been applied to coordination between different agencies. This is really creating a quite large new office. We already have an Office of Legislative Auditor. The current legislative auditor described this as an impossible task, I think was the quote that legislative auditor said. The previous legislative auditor is here for nearly 40 years, described this as duplicative and causing jurisdictional challenges. And I think I can see why, because we've got the Office of Legislative Auditor that will continue to exist. We've got the BCA that does investigate cases of fraud in public programs. We've got the existing inspectors general. So can you sort of help explain why this is not an expansion of bureaucracy in a way that sort of how this would actually make a difference given those other agencies? Because it's quite a lot of money, even if we don't fully fund it, as we wouldn't be in the absence of those amendments.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I'll make the argument why the state needs to have an inspector general. Again, first of all, the legislative auditor, who does wonderful work, has no authority besides to say you did something wrong. You know, you need to fix how you do it, okay, which we have seen in audit after audit after audit that's not happening, that the auditor's recommendations, it's the same thing. 2 years later, they say they didn't fix it. And so that's a completely different thing. The BCA, which has just started, but small staff just started looking at fraud cases, and it's not their primary. Their primary focus is on bad, you know, crimes against people, right? I mean, that is a primary purpose of the BCA, and so that's a very different thing. We have had recently in some inspector generals within some agencies. MDE has had two or three since they started a couple of years ago, and I voted for that bill in an interim. Most of the time, half the time, the position's empty. And we have seen from whistleblower after whistleblower after whistleblower that it has been a huge problem within some of these agencies and how it functions. And you have to have independence from, you cannot out-police yourself. And you have to have independence to make this work. Many, 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 many states have an independent inspector general. We don't in Minnesota. And we also have a huge fraud problem, as we all know, and we are all trying to attempt to fix. And so this is something that's highly, highly needed in the state.
Final comment, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Anderson. And no disagreement about the it's incredibly important that we address fraud in our public programs and make sure there's integrity in them. That's important for taxpayers. It's important for the vulnerable people that depend on those programs. And we want to make sure that we do it well and do it upright. And I recognize that each of those pieces, the OLA has a certain piece, The legislative auditor does. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has a piece. The existing inspectors general who are in agencies that have a particular focus, each one of those currently has a piece. I'm not sure how adding another piece on top of that necessarily helps, and I'll continue to look at this along the way. I did just one final note, too. I'm particularly concerned just as a member of the Public Safety Committee. If this bill had so much, got examined so much in the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, there's, you know, establishing a new law enforcement agency, it really, really should be considered, have been considered in that committee, just speaking as a member of the committee. So that concerns me as well. But thank you. And thank you, Chair.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you very much. And just to represent Chair Pinto's statements now, I would like for this committee to know that when this bill went through Judiciary in the Senate, it was only on its sixth engrossment. So the bill has morphed and changed. So unless it went back to the committee, which on the sheet it doesn't show that it did, many of these provisions were not really vetted at all. And they were just added as things moved on. And each committee looked at its own particular jurisdiction but did not look at the bill as a whole, which is why I had trouble with us accepting it at face value when it first came over, period. I was wondering about the definition of misuse also, and I was wondering, last year, and this is to Mr. Sullivan, last year we, in 15.0573, I'll give you a minute to look at that. In the statute for, I think it was for whistleblowers, we talked about misuse, but it wasn't defined anywhere. So I'm just wondering, is there any other definition of misuse as it would relate to this?
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Chair Claiborne, not that I'm aware of. I would need to do a little research, but not that's applicable in this context necessarily.
All right. Thank you very much.
Chair Claiborne, are you finished?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of just going through a couple of different pieces. One thing that sort of stood out to me in the candidacy of the person who would become the Inspector General, the disclosure is primarily around political affiliations, appointments, campaign work, and partisan activities. But there isn't anything about financial disclosure. Is that somewhere else in the bill? I would just think that someone who would be looking at fraud and finances may also want to disclose any financial conflicts they may have.
Representative Anderson.
Page 7.15.
Thank you, Chair Igbaje. I'm going to ask nonpartisan. We thought of them in the same sense of as a commissioner, you know, and that's kind of they're in that sense. And so I don't know if commissioners have to file public disclosures, finance disclosures. I can't remember. Maybe nonpartisan can help.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, so, you know, candidates for the Inspector General, that's the portion of the bill that Representative Igbaje is referring to. I don't see a requirement in there to disclose financial holdings or assets. I think what Representative Anderson is referring to is on page 3 of the bill, the Inspector General and the Inspector General's employees in the office would be designated as public officials. Mm-hmm. For purposes of Section 10A.01, so that requires a statement of economic interest, okay. Annual statement, and you'll see that on line 2.13, yes, under current law, commissioners, deputy commissioners, and assistant commissioners do have to file that statement as well.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Agbaje.
Okay, and then just also to continue on the discussion about the police force, I'm a little bit concerned with the authorization and the fact that, I guess, upon request or at the Inspector General's discretion, they can, like, work with law enforcement agencies to carry out law enforcement duties. And so I'm just wondering kind of like, what is the scope of that? Is that just simply like arrests after a credible investigation, or is that something like raids that we've seen from the federal government?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Vice Chair Igbokje. It would be related to fraud, and it would be essentially similar to what you would probably see with the BCA, what you would see them doing, or the Attorney General's office.
Mr.
Chair. Vice Chair Igbokje.
Okay, and then finally, this law enforcement group is led by a chief law enforcement officer, but it doesn't say in that subdivision four who that law enforcement officer reports to. It's not clear if they report to the OIG or if they report to someone else. I guess I'm just thinking like in terms of like, you know, they have to manage and discipline the other officers. So if something goes wrong, like who is in charge of the chief law enforcement officer in the event that there is, you know, misconduct by this agency?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Chalksa. They would report to the Inspector General, just like there's a chief law enforcement person within other entities, and they report to, you know, up to the BCA commissioner or that sort of thing, or public safety commissioner. So they would report to the Inspector General.
Okay.
They would be part of the staff of the Inspector General's office, essentially. But you have to, if they're doing sort of, if they have arrest due ability, then they have to be a law enforcement entity. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Bajie.
Well, right. So I guess I'm just concerned because it's like this officer or this law enforcement agency then only, so the officers in this law enforcement agency only report to the chief law enforcement officer, but I guess the chief law enforcement officer then is in control of that, but who is in charge of that chief law, like who does that chief law enforcement officer, who are they accountable to? I think I heard earlier that maybe they might also be subject to post board, which if so, I guess that's a little bit helpful, but it's just unclear in here like where that is and like where people would get recourse if there's misconduct that's conducted by this law enforcement agency. And the only reason I say that is, you know, I mean, you know, police do the job that they're supposed to do, but we know that there have been situations where they've stepped out of bounds. And so just really trying to understand, particularly as we are going after something important, that people don't overstep in this space if they become overzealous. So.
Mm-hmm. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. The chief of law enforcement person would answer to the Inspector General, who ultimately answers to the governor. And they're dealing with financial crimes typically. That's what the purpose of this is, financial program crimes, you know, defrauding the state generally. These are not, these are not violent crimes against people or those sort of things, if that makes sense. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vice Chair Igbokje.
Yeah, and that's fair. I guess I just, you know, that's why I brought up the question about the raids, because sometimes if you go in a raid to try to get those financial documents and get the paperwork, you may run into people and they may end up becoming a violent situation. My request would just be that as you continue to work on this bill, to really tighten up that space, to really understand exactly what their roles and duties are and really understand what the recourse is should they overstep that. And especially because, like, as you said, that they are only going after, you know, financial crimes, which I imagine is to, you know, to say out there that this isn't necessarily a violent crime. But unfortunately, in our, you know, tense environment now, things can kind of set people off. And so I just would like to see more dedicated language that really kind of cabins the powers that this law enforcement agency has as, you know, they're trying to do this work for us. So I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did find something else I had to ask about, because this goes to my concern of having MDE, the money from the Office of Inspector General and MDE move over to the OIG, but then the statewide OIG is only doing investigative powers and the sanctionability. On lines 25.1 to 25.4, that they don't have any ability to hear if that, so there's, we talk all the time about agencies sharing information. And if somebody's caught in fraud in one agency, they shouldn't be getting a grant in another agency. This language looks like you're removing that for MDE to get that information or be able to stop something if somebody is trying for a grant in MDE that already got, got taken away in another agency.
Representative Norris.
Chair Torkelson, Chair Joachim, this is in the conforming items section of the bill, so I may rely on nonpartisan staff to confirm this for me, but I believe the reason that the language was removed here in this particular statute is that if and under the bill now when the current MDE Inspector General staff become employees of the centralized office of the Inspector General, elsewhere in the language of the bill, similar authority is granted to the central Inspector General. And so this language in this particular existing statute is no longer necessary because the people who would be executing this language and statute are now employees of the central Inspector General and have similar duties under the Inspector General statute. But I'll defer to nonpartisan staff if I got any of that wrong or there's further clarification needed.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, yeah, I would need to look into this further to be able to weigh in at this point.
Follow-up, Representative Joaquin.
Mr. Chair, that's my concern about the sanctions MDE has and the preemptive items that they can do. They would be able to preemptively say, oh, we heard that you went for a grant in MDH or you did something in the Department of Health. They would be able to then, this takes away their power to be able to say, we're not going to give you that grant in MDE. Because we do some grants to outside agencies in the Department of Education. So I would really want to have that clarified. I'm just concerned from the kind of the misalignment that, like I said, they're taking the money from the MDE OIG to give to the statewide, but then the statewide is only doing investigative. And I'm used to in state government, it's always telling state agencies to do more with less. I'm not used to us telling state agencies or a statewide OIG to do less with more. So this is very concerning to me. Thank you.
Representative Norris.
Chair Torkelson, I do want to just add, you know, that the centralized Inspector General is authorized to do more than just investigations. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we added in state government this year is additional powers and duties that allow them to do a lot of that really important preventative work. You know, those duties start on line 7.30 and continue on to page 8. My understanding is that when the MDE Inspector General staff become employees of the Central Office of the Inspector General, that they will be tasked with carrying out those prevention responsibilities within MDE.
Mm-hmm. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know it's getting late, and I'm probably just slow, and I can take it offline, but I just feel like that's in conflict with 24.12 to 24.17, where it says that the statewide inspector general has assumed responsibilities for identifying and investigating misuse, but not preemptively taking care of it, which is what the OIG office and MDE is doing right now. So maybe we just need further discussion to figure out how this lines up, because that date also is effective from a different date when the office is being taken away. So there's some conflict there. It's kind of similar to what Chair Norris was worried about in the Department of Human Services.
Any comment, Representative Norris?
No, Chair Torkelson, I'll just briefly add, I'm absolutely happy to have an offline conversation. I know that effective date was actually a question that I asked to nonpartisan staff earlier today when we were preparing the amendment, and I think the understanding was that that didn't need to change, but we can certainly have additional conversation.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for one, I'm very glad that we finally got this to this point. Representative Norris, I saw you in committee 4 times. Representative Anderson, you were there as well. Thank you for pushing for this, working with the working group. I was glad to occasionally join the working group to make sure that this was doing well. But I'm a little concerned. I'm not hearing a lot of yes votes over there. I'm really hoping this makes it out of committee because this is an important thing. This is what Minnesotans are asking for when they're looking at record fraud. And, you know, I find it amusing that we're hearing from our DFL colleagues who have had record spending coming out of their caucus and talking about wanting to spend even more, that they're now concerned about the spending on this. But congratulations on getting this done. This is an effort that has required a lot of lifting. You know, getting it out of the committee, StateGov was Herculean. But I think that I'm really hopeful that this makes it out tonight because I'm not hearing a lot of yeses. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Final comments to the bill as amended. Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. Appreciate the discussion we've had today. I've been taking notes up here and we'll consult with nonpartisan staff to make sure some of these things are squared away. But I think overall, when you step back and look at what this bill attempts to accomplish, this is a bipartisan, bicameral effort to address the significant issue we have here in Minnesota with fraud. I've said from the start that it's unacceptable, it shouldn't be tolerated, and we need to take action. And this bill represents a substantial action and a substantial step forward. I want to thank Representative Anderson for her partnership. I want to thank our colleagues in the other body as well. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to continue moving this along. And part of the reason that I've always wanted to be diligent with this work and with this bill, and we did have to make multiple visits to StateGov, is I wanted it to be able to be effective on day one and deliver for Minnesotans what they expect out of this office. And I think with the changes that were incorporated today, with some of the feedback that we've received, we'll make sure that this office is able to do that and deliver the sort of responsible stewardship of taxpayer dollars that Minnesotans expect from us.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you. This is a good bill. Not all of us got, we started with House File 1, which we did go through a million committees last year, and we got stuck in StateGov too. And you know, this wasn't what each one of us, you know, had in mind in the beginning. There were big differences between the original bill. This is the Senate file and the House File 1. But through a really, really good process and a lot of good people working on this bill who all want the same thing. What we want is we want the fraud to stop. We want to put something in place that can work for the long, long term under many future legislatures, many future governors, and can, you know, and so the public knows that we're going to put a stop to this, and we're going to. So that's what this is. We feel like it's a really good work product, and we hope you support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Co-Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this was a robust conversation. And you know, to Chair Nash's comments, we'll move the bill out. We had an agreement. We got there. We'll get the bill out, and we'll continue to have conversations. The concerns you hear today are valid concerns. You may not agree with them, but they are concerns of the members on this side of the table. But we're moving forward. My biggest concern with this bill is that if we are creating duplicate services that we don't need to create, we could spend that money in other places. We know there are needs in the state. We know people have needs, and we could spend that money there. I'm all for intervening and stopping and holding those accountable that commit fraud. We all can agree on that. But if there's a way to do it without duplicating those services and spending money that we don't need to, that we could spend other places, I think we should do that. We absolutely should address the concerns that were raised by Representative Baje. We're giving broad police powers. We should make sure that we have guidelines for accountability into that. We've seen where that has taken us, and we do not want to be international news again in the state of Minnesota. I'll end with that, Chair. Looking forward to continuing this conversation as we move forward.
Thank you, Chair Frazier. Members, I want to thank you for a thorough discussion. I think we've discovered a few minor points that may be needed a little repair work here and there. But overall, you know, the need is great. The cost is significant, but it's minimal compared to the amount of money that taxpayers have lost to fraud in these last years. And while there may be some duplication, it's obvious that the current systems don't work. Our administration has been unable to address fraud for many years, and we've seen millions, hundreds of millions of dollars lost. The cost of this bill is significant, but it's nothing like the amount of money that has been given up to fraud by the current administration. Chair renews his motion that that Senate file 856, the second unofficial engrossment as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The bill passes. You're on your way.
Chair,
Co-Chair Frazier, would you like to give us a preview of tomorrow's action?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have calendar bills for tomorrow. We will be back here at 12:15 tomorrow. Everybody have a good night. Drive
safe.
Thank
you. This meeting is adjourned.